Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest installment of Pod Stallions, the podcast that is based off the website Plaid Stallions. You knew that. I am Brian, and with me in La La Land is the ever-dependable Jason.
Hello, everybody. I am in La La Land, not just location, but just as a mental state as well, just for the record.
Where we all hope to be. and this week's topic, this, you know, special second episode for October is Mad Monster Party, a Rankin Bass film. And I want to throw out a shout out to Todd Killinger, who was the one who sent me via the Pod Stallions Facebook page a suggestion we should do Rankin Bass.
Okay.
Hey, and I texted Jason, why don't we do Mad Monster Party? And you said, I was thinking the same thing, so...
I was, yeah. I was just about to text you the day that you texted me about doing another episode, and I was about to... Something distracted me, and I didn't get back to it, but I was going to say, hey, what's your schedule like this week? And then I was going to throw Mad Monster Party out as one of my suggestions. So, yeah,
that was my only idea, so I'm glad that worked out. But before we get into that, there was a TV movie we both saw this week, and we wouldn't be good 70s kids, and of course me being a huge fan of Fantasy Island, if we didn't talk about My Dinner with Hervé, the new biopic starring Peter Dinklage. And as I was saying to you offline, and I think you were saying the same thing, I forgot it was Peter Dinklage.
And just as someone that gets uptight about these things with, you know, with accents or people trying to, you know, there's loads of interpretations and ways to play things where you may not get the perfect physical embodiment, but if you get the voice and the mannerisms right, you forget her, you ignore it, etc. Dinklage was like, I did start to forget that physically, like, you know, I'm saying from the neck down, their bodies couldn't be more different. He couldn't be so more different physically the way he looked. And I started to forget what Vilichet looked like because he got that voice. He got the voice so right. Not just the accent, but the voice itself. As if he's been doing it, you know, for years and been waiting for an opportunity like this.
My party favor,
Seriously.
I even said to you that at the end they show the director and the real Vilichet from the evening. And it kind of was like, oh, yeah, he looks nothing like Peter Dinklage, you know, but it took me a minute to, it was a good engrossing film and I couldn't turn it off, but.
It didn't blow me away.
No,
he
it's
did.
Not,
he thought was wonderful. And the movie was kind of by the numbers, but I have to say, and I mentioned this to you off there too, as interesting as it was watching Dinklage and sort of forgetting, you know, what Vilichet looked like, because he really nailed it. I'm not sure I've seen another portrayal in recent memory that was quite as ridiculous as Andy Garcia playing Ricardo Montalban.
Could not agree more. And like I said to you, it felt more like Andy Garcia was doing Eugene Levy doing Ricardo Montalban. Like it was goofy. And was he wearing makeup?
Well,
was he wearing a prosthetic?
I feel like they did something to his nose, very, very slight. And again, if you know, you think Andy Garcia, Ricardo Montalban, and you go, oh, okay, that might work. And you don't necessarily, you're not gonna mistake them for each other. Like physically, it doesn't really work. But it was the acting and he didn't even bother with an accent to play it with the very thick and distinctive accent that Montalban had.
Montalban also had a really distinct cadence.
Yes, totally. Like
he very distinct way of speaking. So if you couldn't do the accent, you could at least, you know, and instead he's just doing this. And it's like, no, that's, you know,
Montalban, there's a scene where he's outside of Villachez's limo and he's trying to say, although I don't, you know, I've been told, don't love the sin, but love the sinner, or, you know, whatever he's trying to say. Come on out, but we got to film this thing. Your whole, you know, the TV family is here. We need to do this. Montalban could have, you know, sold ice cubes to Eskimos. His cadence, yes. Just his, and Andy Garcia, he might as well have been in The Untouchables. It was like an outtake from The Untouchables. Not even remotely. It was laughable. Like it was. I started to watch it and thought there must have been people on set going, "This is ridiculous. Like this has taken an interesting subject and the highs that were there with Dinklage, and all of a sudden this left turn comes in with this bizarre portrayal. It was just ridiculous.
It kind of reminded me, and although I think he did a much better job, is there's a movie called The Rat Pack, came out in the 90s. And,
oh, yeah.
And it's got some great casting. I think Leota is Frank Sinatra in it.
Leota Sinatra, and I think, I want to say, Joe Mantegna is Dean Martin.
And that's where I wanted to go.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't look like Dean Martin, but he just played it different. You know, he didn't do a gross caricature. He kind of just played it like Joe Mantegna. And
he did, but he also kind of, there was a cadence to the way Dean spoke.
Yeah, and he just tried that.
Yeah, he tried to sort of, it's like Leota. Leota played Sinatra. And again, on paper, you go, this is not a really good idea. Like Toby Huss, no one but Toby Huss should be playing Sinatra in anything ever. Or Joe Piscopo.
That's right.
You know, Toby Huss has the voice and the mannerisms and, you know, he does that show every now and then in L.A. that Uncle whatever Booze-a-thon or something, and he's Frank Sinatra's cousin. He does this variety show that, you know, is on stage kind of thing, and he just the singing voice, the way he dresses, the voice, everything. So Leota was like, there were little moments here and there where you kind of thought, oh, that seems a little bit like the essence of Frank, but he didn't sound like him, he didn't look like him. Mantegna, I think was the winner, and somebody who played Peter Lawford. There's a British guy I think who played Peter Lawford.
I forget. He was pretty good.
And did
good,
Don though. Cheadle play? Did Don Cheadle play?
Cheadle played Sammy Davis Jr. And I think he was kind of the standout for me.
Yeah, he was good too. I remember that. Yeah. That's not a bad movie.
Kind of forgettable, but yeah, I was really excited to see it at the time. But
anyway. And the only thing I'd say also about the Villachez thing is I was really disappointed that we did not cover any talk show stuff, and I'm thinking specifically of the Mike Douglas show, maybe it was Murder, where he comes out and sings and does a track from his his album, you know, why are people so mean, or whatever the song was.
Oh,
I kind of thought we'd get into there a little bit of other things that he was sort of doing, like they did the Dunkin' Donuts thing, and I'm sure you were very excited by the prototype lunchboxes that were made in that one scene. I bet you saw that and thought, I'd like to have one of those.
Yeah, except those, I don't think those existed. I would have liked to have seen real Fantasy Island merch, but I understand that's few and far between. But the thing I think I was surprised at was there was a couple of films omitted. One is the one and only, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but I've seen it more than I should. It's a film during Henry Winkler's Fonzie popularity. He got a TV movie made where he becomes a wrestler.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that movie. Yes. It doesn't take place like in the 30s or something.
I think it's in 30s. The 50s. Yeah.
The 50s. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Like it's the height of TV wrestling.
Okay.
And Villachez is in that as one of the cornermen in wrestling, you know, the what do you call those guys? robe and your spit bucket. I don't know what you call them.
Oh, like a trainer, like a manager, like a trainer.
Yeah. He has a couple.
I did like the Billy Barty, the red carpet.
That was fabulous. Yeah, that's what I wanted to see. Yeah, and I couldn't believe they didn't talk about the Forbidden Zone at all. Richard Elfman's film.
Oh, that's right. He was in that. What? Yeah, 1980 was it, or 81?
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a crazy movie.
It is. I totally forgot he was in that. And he was in that while he was doing
Fantasy Island.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And I remember him promoting that. I remember him talking about that, how he wanted the world to be this place where you didn't have to work for money. And, you know, he had this whole utopian thing. And I was surprised they didn't even discuss that a little bit, because that may be the thing he ends up being best remembered for.
Yeah. Interesting. I totally forgot about that. In fact, his the on-off girlfriend, the wardrobe woman, actress.
Yeah.
How do you say her name? Marie Enos or something? Just ran into her at the studio when I was doing a session a couple weeks ago. She was in there.
Oh, no kidding.
Same time. We were chatting in the lobby about... she did that show with Joel Kinnaman with The Missing, or the she's a cop. Good show. First season was great. But yeah, who knew that... I didn't know she was going to be in this thing. So there you go. It would not be Pod Stallions without starting an episode about Mad Monster Party and Halloween and instantly veer into the Hervé Villechaize.
We'll connect it all together later.
It'll wrap up. Yeah,
it'll all make sense. So, you know, keep filling out that tapestry. Mad Monster Party. I don't know about your first experiences with it, but for me, it could not have come at a more perfect time in my life. I have always been, and I think you share this, a Halloween kid.
Yeah.
And during Halloween down here, the Buffalo stations, the Western New York stations, used to have like a week of monster movies. And for me, this was like madness. You know, this was like adults being kids. And I always really loved this time of year, especially this week ramping up to Halloween. And yeah. I can remember Channel 2 played a new monster movie every day, and I would run home, and I had never heard of Mad Monster Party as a kid. Like, it's not like, even though it's a Rankin Bass special, it doesn't have that Rudolph sort of, you know, CBS every Thanksgiving kind of thing. It just plays when it plays. So... Mm-hmm. I remember catching it, and I caught it a bit late, and I don't quite remember what happened, but I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And I think I may have been at a friend's house, and then, you know, my friend had to have dinner, and I like waited till a commercial, then I ran my ass home and turned the TV on there just to catch the ending of it. I can honestly remember, like, there's no such thing as a VCR. Well, there was, but they were in the rich part of town. So that is my first recollection of it, is turning the TV on and going, what the holy hell is this? It's amazing. And then having to run home to catch the part with the Kong monster. The, you know, what is it called? It in the film?
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
It.
And I do not remember the songs.
Here's the thing. It's funny that we don't know how old you were, but it sounds kind of similar. But to go back to something we repeat often on the show, it ends up being one of those things that once you start to learn more about the project itself, you start to realize, oh, that would make complete sense, that it would be something that would attract, would get my attention. It, you know, the people that are involved with it, the people that, you know, Jack Davis and...
Jack Davis is the character designer, yes.
And Harvey Kurtzman. And these legends, you know, you go, well, of course, this would appeal to me. And for me, it was Catch It on Television. Yeah. And at that point, the only connection I could make was that I had no idea, you know, who Rankin Bass were. I wouldn't have understood that as a as a, you know, 8-year-old or
but
whatever
you knew
it was.
The brand.
But I knew that there was something similar. See, when they would when the word animation was used to describe something like, you know, the classic animated Rudolph is going to back on television, and animated to me meant Looney Tunes, meant the Warner Brothers cartoons.
Oh,
and I could never understand. As a child, I couldn't understand how what I was watching in Rudolph, which looked three-dimensional, looked like I could put my hand through the screen and touch these figures, how that was animation.
You had no clue of stop motion?
When I was probably six or seven, I didn't really understand what stop motion was.
I'm acting like I was worldly. You know why? Well, remember CBS In the News? Those segments on Saturday morning?
Saturday morning,
I caught one on Harryhausen doing Golden Voyage of Sinbad as a kid.
Oh, perfect, yeah.
And I remember being like 5 or 6 years old going, I want to do that for the rest of my life, which I never did, but that's another story.
You got sidetracked.
I was just saying this to my wife. It's like the thing I envy most about my kids is when I wanted to be Ray Harryhausen, I couldn't figure out how to be him. You know, my parents were like, you can borrow the film camera. What are you going to do? And, you know, there were no books in the library.
Right.
The magazines sucked in my town. There was no way of figuring out how to do stop motion for me because nobody knew what I was even on about. My kids can go on YouTube. My daughter draws anime every day. And, you know, she's like, if I want to know how to do eyes, I just watch 50 YouTube videos.
Right.
You know?
No, my kids were in the weeds.
My son was stop motion animating when he was like 7 because he found an iPhone app for it and started.
You know, it's funny you just say this because now you're triggering a memory. That kid I always mentioned down the block, Mark
had everything?
Who always had everything. He had a camera. What was it? 16 Super 8 or 16?
Super
what
8,
was the little
probably.
Super 8? And we made a Star Wars movie. I was
Me
Han
too.
Solo. He was Luke, and I think he was Vader as well. So we shot it in sequence, obviously, and it was silent. But it was called the Astro Gem. It was in his backyard. One of my first acting experiences, and he would make Mr. Bill movies. He
no kidding.
Used that camera to make Mr. Bill. Oops, sorry. To make Mr. Bill movies, he did a few of them. So hang on.
No worries.
So I don't know where he would have necessarily gotten the info. I mean, he was a few years older than me. So
right.
So he probably, you know, so he was a couple years older. So he probably was more aware than I was about how these things sort of got made. But it was initially, you know, the word animation used to describe the Rankin Bass stuff. It didn't really register.
Yeah.
It didn't quite make sense. And I had seen the Harryhausen stuff, and I think I'd seen bits of King Kong when it was on one time. And I just didn't know. Special effects to me in my world sort of around that time were Star Wars and these things that were sort of tangible. You know, you'd probably get a glimpse. You know, after you've seen Star Wars for a year or whatever, I'd probably get a glimpse of the creatures on the chessboard and thought, oh, that looks familiar. That looks kind of like the stuff that was in Sinbad or, you know, whatever. But it's one of those things that when I came across it, because I so loved the holiday stuff, you know, Rudolph and Year Without a Santa Claus and Little Drummer Boy and all those things that were huge events when they would get repeated. When I finally saw this thing, I mean, the first time when I saw it, it was like, where did this come from? What? Oh, they made a Halloween special that I've never seen. This must be the equivalent for Halloween as a TV special. I had no idea that it was a theatrical release.
Yeah, me either. I just thought it was a TV special as well.
Okay.
Did when you were a kid and you turned on the TV and there was something with animated dinosaurs or Sinbad, was that to you like finding a 5 in an old coat? Because for me, that was always like, holy shit. You know, like...
I remember
it was...
There's an episode of Twilight Zone and I can't think of the name of it, which is embarrassing, but the airplane.
The Brontosaurus at the
And when they come to the Brontosaurus, and then it would go to commercial. I started to look for that episode just to be able to see the Brontosaurus look up.
That was a Willis O'Brien, by the way. That was like from a movie from the 20s.
But it worked for me. It was like, that's something that doesn't exist, and there it is. And I mean, I knew the difference between the giant, the lizards that were made huge in those movies. Oh. I knew the difference between that and, the creatures and how they were original and stuff. I just didn't quite understand how it worked.
I remember as a kid, there was some movie advertised, Lost Continent type movie, dinosaurs, and I stayed up all night. My parents were asleep and I was sneaking around, and I get to that movie and the credits roll and I'm so excited, and I saw some stupid iguana, with a thing on its head, and I was probably 11. I was probably like, son of a bitch, I'm done. And I went to bed. I never finished the movie. I was so disappointed because, I didn't stay up for a lizard, being filmed in slow motion. I stayed, either it's a man in a rubber suit or it's stop motion. That's where I'm still like that. If I watch an old movie and it's just stupid fake dinosaurs, I get mad.
there's a charm to it, but yeah, it's pretty lazy. You started to understand before too long, that was a lazy way of doing it. When you start to see more and more of this stuff and you understood what it was or what it took to do it. But yeah, Mad Monster Party was like, and I think we're similar in this way too, where, didn't someone just post something about Burger Chef on the Plaid Stallions thing, or where was it? They posted an article about Burger Chef. And I always just have to be reminded that Burger Chef had monsters. Some of the characters that were on their merchandise were these Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein type monsters in the mid 70s. And then we had the monster cereals, and the monsters and Addams Family in the afternoons were on, and so on and so forth. And so we got pretty monster crazy. So when I found Mad Monster Party, it was like, four bowls of the monster cereal, just for my eyeballs, like everybody's in it, And I'm gonna make a confession here, which I don't think I ever have before. Maybe not to anyone, but Francesca did something weird to me as a kid. I was,
why?
Oh my goodness, she's
that she looks like a Playboy cartoon come to life. And Francesca's a good example, and she did the same thing for me. But that's a good example too of what kind of fun adults would have with kids stuff back then. There, that's obviously, her proportions are a little sultry, and we used to take little it would go right over the kids' heads and the adults would dig it, right? She's pretty sexy, and I honestly think she might have been the prototype for Jessica Rabbit.
Even
right down to I think her name is Gail Garnett's voice is very close to Kathleen Turner's in that kind of husky, sexy voice that she had.
Yes, she was a folk singer who only did, this one song that was a big folk song, like, we'll sing in the sunshine.
Is that her?
I'm pretty sure that's her.
My mom locked the station to, easy listening, middle of the road from day I was born to about 83.
Because
so
someone covered it. There was a cover, a female artist covered it in the mid 70s or something. But I don't remember who, it was someone like, not Carly Simon, but someone, Helen Reddy or someone like that or something. And it was, I don't know the other one, Tony Tini, I don't know who, but it was a fairly big, I think it got radio play. Like, that's what I sort of remember it from. But I think this one she did was in the early 60s. But yes, probably a Jessica Rabbit prototype. But you hit on something really interesting about the the vibe, and adults having fun with, you know, with
kid stuff.
Kid stuff. We're into this really strange realm in the 60s with things like, you know, Mad Magazine and the Munsters and the Addams Family and this movie.
And the whole camp thing, even.
The camp thing and these things that were purposely put in there to wink at adults. It's a very... I see this movie and I think this is right. I think it's 67 or 68, this movie. And so so it's still kind of in the early 60s vibe of jangly guitars and, you know, sort of, you know, pop art sort of, you know, logos and things like that. It's all mixed into this same blender of all that stuff in the 60s. It doesn't, you know, for a 67 or 68 thing, it doesn't go to, you know, freak out. It's still sort of in that
right.
earlier
it's
60s.
Not psychedelic yet,
right? And the songs are very you know, guitar group from the early 60s, a little bit of, you know,
it's a Beatles
nightclub.
It's a Beatles knock
and the Beatles thing, and then, you know, the Phyllis Diller song. I mean, she was, I don't know how many kids knew who Phyllis Diller was. You know, I know.
Well, she was a television fixture. I knew who Phyllis Diller was. I didn't know what she did.
Yeah, but would you have known?
I knew who Carol Channing was. You know, why?
I think I probably knew who Phyllis Diller was when I was, you know, 8 or 9 from talk show appearances. I wouldn't have really had much idea what she was joking about or what her nightclub act was or just how revolutionary she was as a female comic and the stuff that she talked about. So that's a real wink to the audience that are probably taking the kids to this movie, or that was the idea, you know, to cast her. Is pretty fantastic, you know. And then
well,
Karloff.
I think the big get is Karloff.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, he went on to do The Grinch, but this is absolutely one of my favorite things he ever did, and it's nice that he was able to go that way with his career and actually kind of embrace it and poke fun at it. And of course he did, you know, he had an epic career and you know, he even ended on a high note with stuff like this, The Grinch and Targets, I think are, you know,
yes,
three
this,
of his
this was one of his last things. This was one of his last projects, wasn't it? Like
it's hard to tell because I think it probably took like a year to make.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably wasn't one of his last projects. Like he probably did the voiceovers years before. I think he died in 68 or 69.
Okay.
So actually, his last films are horrible. They're Mexican productions. And talk about a work ethic. Apparently, he was going to, in between takes, he had to lie down with an oxygen mask.
Jeez.
And it wasn't like he needed the dough. I think he was just one of those people who didn't stop working.
And Target was, I think he's only in, he's in one location, I think, for the most part in that movie. And he doesn't,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's amazing that he did it, but it was, yeah, I think it was, he wanted to keep working.
Because his movie clips are from Corman movies. Like,
that's right.
I forget, I know that, the same guy, I think, who did his last films with him was a guy by the name of Jack Hill. And he gets a credit in Targets because the scenes of his character, I can't remember the name of his character in Targets, in a movie are actually from Jack Hill's The Terror. And The Terror gets used a lot as stock footage in other films.
Yes. Yeah. That was where he's sort of wearing the hat. Isn't he in that?
Yeah.
Karloff?
Yeah, yeah,
the,
yeah.
Whatever that is. But yeah,
I think his name is Orlok in Targets. It's been a long time.
Well, again, back to the whole, the vibe of it and seeing Karloff like that. Like, I had a pretty good idea who he was by the time I had seen the thing the first time. And then, of course, the actual, you know, puppet looks like him. But it was, you know, like we said, every creature we could think of was sort of riffed on and thrown in. It was like a greatest hits package. And then the kid in it with the glasses, and I forget the actor's name, But he did several voices in it, and I know he did so he does the kid sounding like Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart, which is very jarring as an adult now. Like I didn't mind it as a kid, but it's really hard to listen to now as an adult.
Well,
I think the guy's name is Alan Swift, by the way.
Alan Swift. He did that, and he did I want to say Charles Lawton voice, like the ship's captain or something. And then
ship's captain is definitely a Charles Lawton.
And then Sidney Greenstreet for the Invisible Man, which is a really interesting way to go in 66 or 67.
He also did the Yelch, who was, he's doing Peter Lorre. And this is a funny story, and I'll just give you the backstory. One, this movie is a huge tradition in the Hyler House. I introduced it to, actually, my friend Charlie lent me a copy of it, and then I got my own copy of it. And I introduced it to my kids, who I think liked it, but after my wife, who hates it, expressed how much she hates it.
Why did she hate it so much?
It just drives her crazy. She has no childhood recollection of it, and she hates the music. She especially hates Phyllis Diller's "You're Different," and she despises "Our Time to Shine," which is sung by Gail Garnett. Because there's just some line in it where she goes, "It's our time to shine," and it's like nails on a chalkboard for my wife. So she's not a fan. Where was I going with it? Oh,
in your household.
Somebody, I think Peter Lorre was in something, and my kids said, "That's just somebody ripping off the butler from Mad Monster Party."
Oh, that's funny.
And I laughed, and I was like, I would have thought it was somebody ripping off Boo Berry as a kid, right? Like, that's, everybody knows the Peter Lorre, but
right. It
doesn't necessarily mean we know who Peter Lorre is,
right?
You know, like, I just always found that kind of hilarious. You know, he is very often imitated, but we don't even, it's become so part of pop culture that when someone talks like this, you don't even know. That was bad, by the way.
Well, but
I don't even know where it's coming from.
Well, no, but it's funny because, again, we talked about this, how these incredibly distinctive voices all ended up being cornerstones of, monster stuff, horror movies and things. And Peter Lorre, it's just, you think about the little butlers. I mean, people do the Peter Lorre voice when they're doing like an Igor sort of. I don't think Peter Lorre ever did an Igor character in any of those movies. He did.
I'm not even sure Peter Lorre was ever in any of the classic Universal monster films.
Right. But suddenly people riff on that voice when they're doing, "Yes, master, I'll bring the thing to you," and they do that thing. And it's also,
let's just go there. Frankenstein, people, when they think of Frankenstein, people will put their arms out and walk like a moron. That's Glenn Strange. Like,
yeah.
Glenn Strange is like one of my least, like, I like his look, but he's not a great actor. And I just think that's funny that's what pop culture, that's what the public caught on to, not this, not the many other brilliant iterations of the character.
Well, and think about Boris Bickett, the Monster Mash. You start to think, well, that's how the Frankenstein monster spoke. It was Karloff, so that's how he spoke. Oh, yeah, then that reminds me. Yeah, that's how he spoke. And it doesn't make any sense. It's just that he had this distinctive voice that was in horror movies, but not necessarily,
about it, Bobby Boris Pickett broke it down. It's the same way I once heard somebody say, people aren't doing William Shatner impersonations. They're doing Kevin Pollak doing William Shatner impersonations. Yeah,
right. It's more than something else.
They've heard somebody break it down and make it easy for them by taking all his tells.
Well, speaking of annoying, if you want to see annoying, find the YouTube video of Boris Pickett singing Monster Mash or miming to it on some I don't know if it was American Bandstand.
You know, up until his death,
it would just make you want
to punch. Up until his death, I actually used to love when like some shit show would bring him out now to sing the Monster Mash. It's like how like I'm sure he got paid, and I don't really have issue with it, but how much agony is it to like, oh, it's Halloween, I get to do the one thing everyone remembers me for. You know, like the other 11 months of the year go to hell, Bobby Boris Pickett. But yeah.
You know, I'll just say this. I worked on a show once for NBC where 80s act would come on and do like a minute and 20 second version of one of their hit songs, and then come back later in the show and cover a more modern song, and the audience would vote on who won. And so I would go, like, I went to meet what's his name from Loverboy, spent a day with him and filmed a bunch of stuff with him, and Martha Davis from the Motels, who I had known from another show and stuff like that. And I went to where Tommy Two-Tone works as the IT guy at some office, and that's his main job. And he does parties. You know, he'll do parties now and then, where he will sometimes play 8675309 like three times at the same show. So, you know, he probably wants
how
to trot out a few things he's written
people?
Recently or well, they're just going, play the one that we know again. And you know, okay, I'll play Jenny again. And we would do it like up to three times at a
whatever event he would. As interesting as he is to people in July as he is in November. That may not be much, but that's up for debate. But what I meant with Bobby Boris Pickett is, like, you know, it must have been very tense for him the week leading up to Halloween, which offers to take, right? Because he's only going to get that, like,
that's true.
I can't imagine, I don't know anyone else that's in that situation. And maybe there's somebody who has like a Christmas one hit wonder but like, that's it, man. That, you know, they used to drag his tired ass up there and he would lip sync the Monster Mash. And my wife would always want to change the channel. And I had this like weird schadenfreude. Oh, no, I got to watch this. You know?
It's the energy he puts into it.
Oh, yeah. If you look at his eyes,
the facial expression,
he's on the clock, man. That's, you know, he knows. And that's, I think, and this is probably putting way too much into it. There's also just this aura of defeat. Like, he knows this is it. This is fame. It's almost a monkey's paw thing. You know, like, I want to be famous and known around the world for my song. And they're like, the devil's like, all right. Enjoy fighting
well,
the Monster Mash for
50 years. You know, the novelty songs, like the Purple People Eater, things like that, that, you know, that just became staples at just certain times of the year.
But nothing like the Monster Mash.
They ran out of gas.
Like, even Ray Stevens
like
had a
Mash.
Catalog.
Well, you're saying that you'd see him on...
Like
variety
shows.
Like,
I can't even, any of them, but, you know, it'd be just close to Halloween and some dumb talk show would have him on, or some, you know, Fox event would have it. It was just that thing you'd do if you were doing a spooky variety show. Like, maybe you could get Elvira, but, you know, Bobby Boris Pickett was one of those things.
Bobby Boris Pickett was probably the ultimate.
Yeah.
He was probably there during the taping just in case somebody dropped out.
Butch Patrick
and then when someone dropped out,
so.
They right. So Boris, you know the song. Let's get you to mime it. We've got it all queued up.
I actually kinda like the Monster Mash. Don't get me wrong. Like as a kid I think it's a great song. I just always kind of found it odd the way like they would only bring this guy out on like the week before Halloween to perform, and then because he had nothing else.
Well, speaking of the genre and these topics, isn't it interesting that there was such an era of comedy regarding
I think that's the whole, sorry, I'm kind of piecing together a thesis here. The whole revival, the whole shock theater package, and then it entering pop culture in the 60s, and, you know, the 60s with the camp, and the there was absurdism there. And these movies were no longer taken completely seriously, although I think they're, you know, most of them are respected for the classics they are. But you had things like trading cards with wacky sayings with the Universal Monsters on them, or you... I think there was at one time a TV show that just showed old pictures from classic cinema and dubbed it over, or dubbed over the silent films. I remember reading about it in Famous Monsters, and that Lon Chaney was.
Well, I was
going to
say, speaking of, do you think a lot of that came from Ackerman and the tone of Famous Monsters, and
this ties into Mad Monster Party. There was a long-standing rumor that Ackerman had something to do with the script that just doesn't seem to want to go away, but the people involved with the script have denied it vehemently, saying no, he had nothing to do with it, he never saw it, and I kind of believe them because it feels like
the double entendres and the winks and everything in the lines. It does feel like the way he wrote
Except
the magazine.
Except that Ackerman was never afraid to take a compliment or a credit, and he never came out and said he did it. So that to me is a big tell. I mean, Ackerman would take credit for something he did, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but he was not shy, and I don't ever remember there being any controversy as to him saying that. So yeah,
right, but he never denied it.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I'm not going there.
I'm kidding. I have no idea. So you got Jack Davis, who, again, like I said at the top of this, I may not have necessarily understood the influences or what all of these elements were, but there was an appeal there immediately. Like it made sense that I would latch on to.
Yeah,
the
because
look of it.
Yeah, you were a mad and kid like I was, I'm sure, right? Like that was, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And
well, because the Frankenstein's monster and the Dracula, to me, are totally Jack Davis. Like that became sort of, I think of that, I look at that Frankenstein monster and I think about the poster.
Yeah,
he
that
did.
Six, it's got the, this, the it's got a, it, they look like cousins. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. There was a sort of whimsy to some of his stuff, you know, because of Mad, and it just would make sense that he would be involved with. And then Kurtzman, you know, that I mean, Harvey Kurtzman, I think, wrote
he
it.
Was,
co-wrote
he was the
it.
Main writer, and there was a co-writer. And I think that explains a lot of the little, you know, adultism in it. The sexy Francesca,
right.
and things like that. And that's kind of where Kurtzman was always very good at writing things that kids wanted to read but felt like they shouldn't be reading. Like, it felt adult. You know, even when you read,
right.
Like, I remember reading his, they reprinted a lot of the early Mads he did. Remember those back? They would put like a little comic book in there. And I can remember reading those thinking like, oh my God, if my parents knew I was reading this. Like, it had this vibe to it. Even though they were like 20 years old when I was reading them, you know?
I remember the women. And a lot of the Mad, like the
things.
It was they were
even
sexy,
even worse.
They,
was
they
did you ever read Cracked? I loved Cracked magazine, by the way. It was okay. I mean, Mad
I
was definitely
it.
Like the Coke, but Cracked magazine was the Pepsi, I guess. And it was okay to drink a Pepsi.
Yeah, but there was also an RC cola in there. What was the third one? Was
crazy
it crazy?
And
crazy was
sick,
like the RC
and they
cola.
Were, you know, mileage varies. Like I would put crazy more like, you know, the grocery store cola that had the little diamonds on it and it said cola. That to me was crazy. Because I hated crazy. It never got the balance right. It always was a little too upsetting or sickening. And I can actually...
Yeah, it's like you're not even... Not even trying. Like somebody came up with cracked, and then the guys are crazy. Went, we need a name for this. Something that's cracked. So how about crazy? Okay,
when
great.
They added
let's
that
do it.
Clown.
And let's just do some half-assed stuff.
I remember just being, yeah,
the clown.
I just remember I was like on
that's
a long
right.
car ride with my dad, and we went to this middle of nowhere gas station. He said, get a comic for the drive. And they didn't have any comics. They didn't have Mad. They didn't have cracked. I don't know the hell I was. All they had was crazy, so I bought crazy, and I hated it. I just remember driving, like, it was upsetting me. It was so bad. It looked like Mad, but it didn't, and the tone was too dark, and it didn't work for me. But in Crack, there was a guy by the name of Bill Ward who would draw women, and I think he also worked in the smut magazine industry, because... he drew the sexiest women. He had a character called Nanny Dickering, I used to love Cracked. Cracked around the time would do monster issues every year, and I got a stack of them over in the corner here, where they would take pictures. It was like a Famous Monsters, but it was just comedy. They would do captions to monster movie pictures, and that's why I would buy it. But they would always have a Nanny Dickering story, and she'd be dressed like a sexy vampirist or something in them. And you're 9 years old, but you're going, I really like this. And it.
Well, I remember in the movie adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
I would say if it was Spy Who Loved Me or Moonraker or something. And if there was a, who did a lot of the adaptations, the movie spoofs. Who's the artist I'm thinking
occasionally,
of? Occasionally. Not, I don't think
Davis. Would do the occasional one, didn't he?
I'm thinking of that really distinctive look, throughout the 70s, it was very much, he always did the movie one.
I don't know why I can't think of this,
but in other words, they're really close to the actors. They're caricatured, but they're very close. When he did Roger Moore, it was sort of dead on. But there would be women in these things that were
Was it Mark Drucker?
It was weird. Might have been Mark Drucker.
That's the name that I I'm not an official. I know I know Al Jaffe and I know Don Martin and.
Do you know what? You just say the ones I was obsessed with in the magazine were the Don Martin, the Don Martin stuff. I don't know if it's because at that point I knew. Monty Python so well, and the Terry Gilliam stuff, and the weirdness in that art, and the violence and everything else, but the Don Martin stuff was just, it just kind of blew my mind. It's so strange. The angles, and the feet, and the fingers, and the violence, the sheer volume of violence in those things. It's crazy. But there's something, this thing was right in the pocket of the monster craze, I think, but also
By the way, did you know that Don Martin, when we were teenagers, Don Martin left Mad and went to Cracked? Just took all his... Yeah, I just had to look it up because I remembered... In high school, I worked in a variety store, and I was in charge of the magazines, which I really enjoyed. The pornography section was never better curated, but... I can remember, in the late 80s, putting Crack down and going, that's Don Martin. What the hell's going on? He had just marched across the street.
Did he go back? Did he end up going back to Matt?
He did. I think he was very angry with Matt about royalties, I'm just reading. So I have no idea. If he ever went back.
So didn't they used to do special issues that were just Don Martin, or sort of an anthology or a book that you could get that was just the Don Martin stuff?
Yeah, they would do books and stuff compilations? Like that. Yeah, he was huge. I mean, he was absolutely huge.
I used to just love that stuff.
Yeah, he was one in a million.
I should try to find some of that. Yeah, he was amazing. It was, and his all his women looked like the men in drag, basically. There was no attempt whatsoever. It was just everybody kind of looked the same. But yeah, this was right in that pocket of the height of the monster stuff and the comedic stuff. You know, because the Munsters and Addams Family were what, early 60s, like 64,
I want to say like 64, 65
or something.
The same with the Munsters, and this is almost a little bit at the tail end of it, but I don't think the classic Monsters really. I think they burned brightly for the 60s. I think it just kept going. I think with the Famous Monsters start publication, was that in the late 50s?
I think I want to say
most
late
people,
50s. Yeah,
most
like
people
58
seem
or something.
Think that Famous Monsters was doing just fine until Star Wars came around.
I always thought that was kind of true, and then they started to have to look at Star Wars and think, okay, what aspect of Star Wars would kind of fall into our purview? And they went after the creatures and started, you know, putting the creatures on the cover and stuff. I don't think they put R2 and 3PO. I think they took like a Tusken Raider and
They did.
You know,
yeah,
stuff like that.
It still didn't kind of, you know. I think that magazine needed to adapt a little bit, and it just refused to.
Well, didn't they also? But they were really good about. They were really good in the early 70s about covering darker stuff too. You know,
they went right for the Hammer stuff.
Yeah,
and they went right for The Exorcist and all that stuff because it was still horror, and that was the pulse of the nation. I think the sci-fi explosion really weakened that magazine's brand, I guess, because, you know, Famous Monsters and Buck Rogers is on the cover, it doesn't quite work.
Right, right. And some of the Famous Monsters fans were really upset about that.
Yeah.
You know, that the magazine had sold out in a way, I think.
Yeah, they were going where the money was, right?
Yeah, and, except you put Star Wars on, you know, a copy of, you know, Cigar Monthly, it was going to sell at that point.
Yeah.
Cigar
somebody
aficionado.
Was just pointing out, I forget where what I was watching, if it was a documentary or... I've been watching a lot of documentaries on horror movies and stuff, but somebody was saying, like, if you go back to the mid-70s and look at lurid covers of magazines, it's all sharks. Because of Jaws, like everybody and their brother just put sharks on the cover of these magazines, you know, sharks with blood in the water. You know, it became like, and I kind of remember that. I remember that as a kid.
It was like when Star Wars hit, you had the magazines that existed at the time, like Starlog, you know, and Famous Monsters, whatever that would do covers. But then you always had these, you know, something would come out of nowhere called, you know, Space Fantasy and, you know, Chocolate Chip Cookies or something. It was like a one-off kind of a thing, or the magazine lasted for two issues or whatever, and it just was
distinctly recall buying one called Laser Blast as a kid.
There you go.
And it had a big picture of Chris Reeves as Superman and Han Solo on the cover, and I got inside and it was a bunch of old stills from 50s movies in there.
Right.
Like the most thrown together piece of crap they could. And
you'd also have a lot of those would on, you know, you could figure out what they could sort of afford to put in there or how they could get a hold of pictures. Because a lot of the time there'd be drawings. There'd be special paintings or drawings.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a couple of old issues of some kind of space magazine that devoted to Star Wars, like not long after it came out. And a lot of the pages are someone's, like, you know, rendition of some of the creatures in it or some of the characters because they couldn't find another photo or they couldn't get another picture to put in there or something.
Yeah,
you know, the pullout posters, you know,
the ripoff.
Well, here's what's interesting about, you just talked about your kids liking it. A couple weeks ago, I was over to see my friend Paul. He's got two sons, 7 and 5. And, you know, we ordered food and I thought they wanted, you know, Halloween, I want to see monster stuff. So I brought over, Beetlejuice and, Monster Squad, the movie, and, Mad Monster Party. Now, Beetlejuice, they were getting into, and they kept saying, when does he show up? When does he show up? And I said, he's going to be there any minute. When he gets there, you're going to love it. Just wait. And they loved it. As soon as Beetlejuice showed up, they just, you know, their interest skyrocketed. In fact, one of the kids, the older kid, is going to be Beetlejuice for Halloween now. He's going to be a football player. Wow. And now he's like, that's it. I'm being Beetlejuice. I don't care. I'm doing it. And then Monster Squad, which they like. I think they got a kick out of it. And, it, you know, again, it wasn't too scary or too dark or anything. So they liked both of those. They loved Beetlejuice. And then I left Mad Monster Party for him to show them. And then he gave it back to me. So they got through about 10 or 15 minutes, and it was just too slow for them. It was just too, there wasn't yeah. enough going on, which I get. I totally get.
I get that. I should explain that my in-laws live very, very far away. So my kids were trapped in a car for 8 hours.
Right.
And they became very good at watching films and being patient.
Right.
Another favorite of theirs, they liked Matt, and I would put Mad Monster Party on all the time when we were driving around. I had that DVD player in the car. The other one that they liked, and I think they just liked it because I was into monsters, was they liked the movie Igor, which was a...
Oh, yeah. John Cusack?
2000s. John Cusack, yeah. And Joan Cusack, I think.
And John Cleese, I think, does a voice in there, too.
John Cleese does a voice in it. And, you know, it's funny, as I could act out that film, but I've never actually seen it because it's always going on behind me.
I always feel, I think, car. I saw a bit of it once, and it seemed like, to me, it seemed like a foreign film that had been redubbed or something, like a film that already existed. It had a look
to it. Oh, really?
Yeah, but I could be wrong. It might have been by some other studio that I'm not aware of here or something. But it was kind of dark. I thought it was kind of dark comedy sort of. You know,
it
not...
was a bit dark, and I kind of like it for that. And the CGI characters, as I recall, kind of give that puppet vibe to them. You know, again, I've never sat and watched the whole thing, but you know, I think Mad Monster Party has. A lineage and stuff like The Nightmare Before Christmas as well.
I was just going to say that. You can see the influence there, too. Now, do they like that movie? Do the kids like that movie? Nightmare Before Christmas?
Yeah, in fact, my daughter went through a very big Jack Skellington phase when she was about 8. You know, I think that's just a fun thing for a kid to have. I'm not sure my son liked it all that much, but, you know, he's not up on his musicals.
But that's a remarkable thing about that movie is, you know, I knew who Tim Burton was before that thing came out, and I'd seen Vincent at an animation festival and, you know, stuff like that. So I was aware of the style. So when I started to see images from this thing, I kind of thought, ooh, this is going to be interesting. And there was merchandise made. Hasbro made action figures, and they made
talking figures. I wish I had bought all figures. Those.
I bought all those. I bought a second set. Yeah, I bought a second set because they had gone down to next to nothing. They've been marked down at Toys R Us or whatever because the holiday season was, you know, they thought we got to get rid of these for Christmas or whatever. They sat around. And so I had another set of everything. And when I moved out here, it was probably around 96 or so, that I decided I'm going to sell everything I have sort of, and, you know, get a car and, you know, figure some stuff out and so on and so forth. So one of the sets of things that I sold was the Nightmare stuff, and it was just, so the movie was 93, so around 96, maybe 97, it was just starting to turn that corner where collectors were getting interested in it, because it didn't do much when it came out. The merchandise certainly didn't.
No, I can remember I was friends with Lenny Lee.
Oh, okay.
Lee's Action Figure Guide, and he said something to me like, just buy all that shit. Thinking it was going to be that sleeper thing that everyone ignored when it came out, and it was going to go out the window, and he was right, I think.
He was absolutely right. I ended up selling that stuff for, you know, 5 times what I paid for it at just the right time. But then it was at the right time because then, I think it was June planning, J-U-N planning in Japan, suddenly started to go nuts with Nightmare Before Christmas merchandise, and suddenly there was this new.
I remember that I was trying to get some for my daughter.
It was this new lease on life that it had, and that people started to want that more than the Hasbro stuff. So yeah. It was just the right time to sort of do that. And then, of course, now we're 25 years later, and you go to Walgreens here, you know, in the States, and they have an entire section that's Nightmare Before Christmas. Whether it's snow globes, or it's incredible that has taken on the life that it has, I think.
It reminds me a lot of, when The Simpsons first came out, Mattel made action figures of them, and nobody cared.
I have those.
And then, they just sat.
Yeah,
nobody I remember cared. Them with a big layer of dust on them.
Yep.
And then, 7 years later, Playmates releases figures, and everybody's crazy for them.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting thing of sometimes you're first, but it doesn't matter. You're striking at the wrong time. Same thing with, and Playmates again, Star Trek The Next Generation comes out with an action figure line with Galoob, and nobody comes to the party.
Right.
A few years later, Playmates picks up the license, and it's a phenom.
And it's huge. Well, in fact, I remember I think Danny Elfman wrote, 10 songs, like 11 songs, and he sings as Jack, and there wasn't one Oscar nomination for a song in that movie that year.
I saw that film in the Eglinton Theater in Toronto, which was one of the best, I think it's stupid condos now, it was one of the best theaters in Toronto, it had the best sound, and it was magical, it was amazing.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Instantly fell in love with
downtown it. Just for those films, and I unfortunately also saw Star Trek Generations there, which wasn't magical or amazing,
which ruined the movie going experience for you altogether. What about speaking of merchandise and stuff like this? Now, a few years ago, well, we know that there's a DVD that was released from Mad Monster Party in the mid 2000s or something.
I think it actually got a VHS release because I would rent it. I would reunite with it. And before I had kids, it was always kind of like more of a good idea than it was actually in real. I'd get it home and start to watch and go, oh yeah, there's singing in this. And
yeah, it's more of a fondness for the memory of it. I love it, but it's not something I would put in every year or something.
Well,
if it weren't for my
children, who would actually run around the house singing "It's the Mummy" and stuff like that, like they've totally renewed my love of the film. Now it's attached to my family and it's imprinted on it, and so I love it like a child. If I could get a hold of the movie poster, I would buy it.
The movie poster is really cool, actually.
It's really cool. I've never actually been, and I always go through the old movie posters when I'm at a show and stuff, just because I'm a glutton for punishment. But I think I would actually buy that if I saw it, and it was, it wasn't, I don't know if it's worth a lot of money. I imagine it might be an expensive piece because the film, and I think we should tell folks this, the film did not do very well.
No, it did not. I was going to say, I don't know what kind of merchandise, if there was a comic book tie-in or any kind of stuff like that.
I have the comic, it was actually my friend Sam Noir. He gifted that to me this summer or last summer, and I was so happy. I mean, I think it's right behind me, but I couldn't believe it. He got for me at a show.
They put it. There was a comic that was released when the movie came out. You're saying?
Yeah, I think Dell did it.
That would kind of make sense.
Home of the great comic books, Dell.
That's right. Take that, Marvel.
Yeah.
and then, I don't know, a few years back, maybe 10 years or so or less, they did some action figures. I forget who did them, but they did a Karloff, and I think they did...
It was Diamond Select Toys.
It was Diamond, and they did the Karloff, and they did a Frankenstein monster? Is that what they did?
They did the Dracula, they did the Frankenstein, and they did the Karloff, and they promised Wave 2, and of course... I guess no one came to the party, and it's too bad because they are gorgeous.
I've got the Karloff. I wanted that one specifically. I've got that.
Comes with a little cartoon bat, and I really wanted a Wave 2. You know, I want a Francesca. I want a Felix.
You and me both.
Yeah. And no, they never did it. The soundtrack got released in the 90s. I don't think I want that because, well, I might want to bother my wife because I could play, you know, Our Time to Shine and You're Different ad nauseum. There was also little statues that came out ages ago by an unknown company called Funko.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows what happened to them.
Oh, yeah.
Those came out at a weird time in my life. I don't remember. I remember walking by them at a comic store and going, oh, cool, and not buying them. Like, you know, either maybe it was the fact that they were just little statues or, you know, I don't know what part of my life I was at, but I remember walking by them, not buying them, and now they're impossible to get. They're like $80 each when you do find them.
So was that, were they bobbleheads or just like a...
No, they're just little... I don't remember, they're bobbleheads. They're called something. What are they called? Hang on 2 seconds. Yeah, they're just little heads. They're not figures, but they did Dracula, the zombie bellhop, which is an odd choice. They did Frankenstein, but he's in a tux. He's not like Fang. And they did the Yelch. And I can't... And the Wolfman. I think they're called Fantastic Plastic.
I vaguely recall those.
They come in these little tubes, and they're really neat. I mean, I don't have a... I actually really like them, but it's just... I missed the window to get them. I think they were fairly limited. And now that, you know, when you do see them on eBay, they're like, you know, this one's $50. And there's they did a Mr. Hyde even.
So. Yeah, I'm actually looking at them right now. They're kind of fun. They're kind of neat. I do remember these.
I do, but I can't remember why I didn't buy them. Like, I think they did two series of them too, and apparently there's even a Francesca. Is there a Francesca?
There is a Francesca, and they're not. You know, terribly expensive.
Yeah.
But they're kind of fun. I mean, they did the little bellhop guy, the zombie bellhop.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't but pick these up.
That kills me too. The zombie thing. That how prevalent. I mean, I know that the word zombie was around since the, I don't know, the 30s or whatever. Yeah. But I mean. Was that a big deal? Were zombies? I mean, that wasn't really a thing. Was it enough of a thing at that time? Sort of was.
Oh sure, I mean, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. It was the zombie, like the white zombie, or the voodoo zombie archetype. I mean, zombie really changed with Night of Living Dead. It became something much more different. You know, the zombie they're using there would be the proper undead slave. You know, even Hammer did a zombie movie, Plague of the Zombies.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah, it's not that good.
Nope, it's a bit dull.
Right, it's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty dull.
It's got
nothing
an iconic looking zombie, and it excited me to watch it. And Hammer is always a tough sell in this house because my wife just finds them boring. She loves horror, but she's like, oh, I don't get your obsession with those. And Plague of the Zombies did not cement my case that Hammer's awesome. Didn't work well.
Yeah. No, Hammer is an acquired taste, I think, because
I think you're right.
There's iconic stuff, but it's not like the movies move at a brisk pace. You know, so when something does happen, you could understand why that the audience at the time kind of went, oh, God, that's frightening. You know, there's a lot of talking, a little bit of romance.
Whenever I try to push Hammer on somebody, I start to realize that I'm being that guy. Like, it's not for everyone, you know, and
totally.
A friend of mine told me a really funny story once. He was installing solar in people's cabins and cottages.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. it would require him to spend, like, the weekend there. So a lot of mm-hmm. these people would, you know, play host. So he'd work all day, and at night they'd hang out with him. And he said he was installing solar in this one guy's cottage, and in the basement of the cottage, it was a pretty decked out, the guy was loaded. He had a decked out cottage, and he had a bar, and in the bar was the framed poster from the movie Cocktail. And my friend said, oh, that's wow. funny. And the guy, turns out this guy was the number one fan of Cocktail ever. His favorite wow. movie on the planet. And my friend's like, oh, I don't think I've ever seen it. And that, of course, was an invitation to sit,
well, we're gonna change
sit
that.
And watch Cocktail. And I'm going to explain why every scene in this matters. And... you know, like, he's telling me this story, and we never went there. We never, but, you know, I just sat there and go, I want to be there. You know, like, I wish I was there to hear how incredible Cocktail is. You know, and this guy was just projecting.
I thought this was going to wrap around.
What's that?
I thought this was going to somehow wrap around to him going, and he also had a poster of, you know, a Hammer film, like in the dichotomy between the Cocktail poster and the Hammer poster.
Oh, no, my story's
you're
going nowhere. I'm Grandpa
this guy's
Simpson
enthusiasm.
Today. Yeah, I just mean that,
got
like,
it.
I have this...
Yes, yeah.
You know, I love Hammer films,
I
but either you like them or you hate them.
Yeah.
You know?
I do that, you know what? I do that all the time with... Well, not all the time, but every now and then with Doctor Who. If anybody sort of, you know, says, like, I kind of like the, you know, this is a few years ago, not the new show. No offense, we haven't spoken about that, but we will someday. No, we haven't.
well, that sounds encouraging.
You know, yeah, I've tried, man. I've really tried. But they, you know, they say, like, well, if I wanted to watch the old show, you know, what should I do or where would I start? And I got to preface it with, let me explain what this show is. You know, much as I love a certain era of that show and what it is, it's going to be jarring for people that have never
yeah.
seen it. And it just, you know, especially with today's eyes, you're going to look at it as like this ultra low budget thing with cardboard sets and everything. So I've had to do that with different movies and different shows throughout the years.
The Unearthly Child. That's where you start.
You know, just watch the William Hartnell ones. You don't
the
need
historical
to go any further.
Ones.
It never got any better. That was the height of it.
But
so there was
a little bit of merch
for this. There's a comic book. There's a soundtrack. It is, you know, it is kind of the forgotten Rankin Bass show.
Well, you know, it's even more forgotten, and I refuse to watch it. Is there's actually an animated follow up that's like a prequel, just called Mad Mad Monsters, and I think that played
okay.
on TV. And I don't think that ever got re-aired, but, you know, you can find it if you're looking for it. And I think it did get a VHS release at some time, but absolutely.
You mean Rankin Bass
did it.
Was it Rankin Bass?
But I don't think it has any of the charm of the film itself. Like, as much as the film has some pacing issues and some songs, I do adore it for what it is. It is gorgeous and fun and you know, it's kind of crazy. But yeah, there's a follow up, and it looks like it would upset me if I watched it. You know,
is it stop motion
it's regular old cartoon?
Okay, that does sound kind of familiar. Maybe that I'd seen a VHS.
Yeah,
I
knew
don't know.
I could rent it. I remember, you know, some of the video stores around here had it, and I don't think I just never wanted to go there because I had read it isn't, if you like Mad Monster Party, and I do, you don't need to watch it. It's not going to do anything for you. So
stay away from it.
Yeah. It's, you know,
interesting.
You know, I,
yeah,
some things I wish, you know, sequels and prequels I wish I had never seen. So I just stay away from it.
Well, and back to the sort of tie in with, or the connection to Nightmare Before Christmas, the brilliance of that, whether you think it's, you know, original or not, or you think it's riffing too much on Dr. Seuss or things that came before it, whatever, there is now a Halloween classic. There's now a holiday classic for Halloween that is in the vein of all these other holiday specials.
Oh, or, yeah. No, you're right.
I think we're in agreement that Halloween is the greatest holiday of the entire year. It's non-denominational. It's about monster movies and candy and fun and dressing up if you want and, you know, scary things and scary movies, and everybody gets to be silly, and there's chocolate and all this stuff. And now there's
Bobby Boris Pickett.
And Bobby Boris Pickett. And now there's a holiday film to go with it.
I agree.
The legacy of that thing, I think, is going to be that there is now this go-to family film for Halloween. There have been, animated monster things or things aimed at kids that are sort of monster related, but not about the holiday, not about the event, I don't think. And except for the Gilda Radner one, the witch party one that I remember to this day. Witch's Night Out. I've never seen it again, but I remember the damn theme, and I remember Gilda Radner doing the voice of the witch. And I think it was done by Nelvana. Was it done by Nelvana?
It was done by Nelvana. I never liked the character designs of that thing, and I think I saw it more than once. And I think I actually got carted out to a library to see it. Like, there's going to be a Halloween thing at the library, and that projector comes out, and it's like, no good, Witch's Night Out again. I don't know.
Wow, so that was a thing that played a lot.
Well, I think the whole thing of Canadian content laws, because it's Canadian project, I showed that to my wife the other day because we were just surfing. We were having a Halloween night, just surfing YouTube and watching things like the Pawland Halloween special and, things from childhood and commercials and... Yeah, we wanted to watch the Peter Pumpkin commercial. I don't know if you had that, where Peter Pumpkin says, "Don't crisscross the streets," and I put on Witch's Night Out, and she looked at me like, "What the hell is this?" And I'm like, "It's Witch's Night Out, with Bazooie and no idea." And there's more than one of those specials, by the way. Those characters are in other specials.
And Gilda
does. No, I don't think the witch
Gilda
is. There's different seasonal specials. With those characters, there's more than one of those.
I take it back. There is one special, but it's not really with monsters. It's the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown.
Yeah,
there is that.
Course.
That was a Halloween thing. But it's not really. If Mad Monster Party had been a 60-minute TV thing, it might have gone over better. It might have been. Better or a half hour thing or something. I don't know. I think it was the thing that got released to the theaters. Nobody really cared. And then it started to resurface on television in the 70s, like the late 70s or something. And nobody really knew what the hell it was. It's not like we couldn't just go to Wikipedia and look it up and figure out where this thing came from.
Yeah.
Who did the music too? Was it Maury Laws? Is that who did the songs or the music?
Oh boy.
Or something? Didn't he do some of the other Rankin Bass stuff?
I don't know.
Am I wrong?
That's kind of out of my... I'm just trying to figure it out if it's on the back of this DVD anywhere. Music by Maury Laws. You're right. And Jules Bass. Okay. Yeah. You've got a scary brain on you, sir.
I don't think any of the puppets are surviving.
I don't think that if there are some surviving, it's very limited because these things just got destroyed after.
Well, what I remember about the Rankin Bass stuff, and it comes to mind last time I watched the Mad Monster Party, is that maybe I'm wrong about this, but you could see on the hands, especially the human type hands, it seemed like the hands got dirtier and dirtier as the show went on, because I think that they were constantly being handled, and I don't know if people were wearing gloves or not, but the fingers start to look a little more gray or a little kind of dirtier. I think because they got moved around so much, maybe?
Definitely, and of course, high-definition television certainly helps that. The one thing that I think is really funny is there's a scene where the characters kind of just run away, and they just do that shoop and all the characters just, you know, they don't animate it. They just kind of like pulled them off to one side very quickly, like whoop. And that is my wife's favorite scene in the movie. She just thinks that's hilarious because, you know, it's just like they couldn't. It's just a little trick that they'll do in these kind of films rather than spend all that time animating them running. The same way that Gerry Anderson always just close up on human hands touching props in the Thunderbirds, you know.
Still never fails to unnerve me.
I can remember as a kid watching that and just suddenly, like,
The human hand just came into this thing. What happened?
Connection.
Are they humans in puppet suits? What the hell is going on?
The other connection I have to it is that here in Canada, especially, the New Adventures of Pinocchio was like on TV so much. It was like the symbol in Southern Ontario, especially, that it was 6 a.m. Like it was a Rankin Bass television show, and like I can honestly remember being like a little kid watching that and turning, I think I was 19 or 20, and I was at a house party that we stayed up all night at, and my friend killing himself laughing to watching Pinocchio at 6 in the morning. Like that's how long it aired on CTV. Like they still were playing that at 6 in the morning.
I don't know if I ever. I think I'm aware of that, but I don't know if I ever.
Oh, you'd
saw
love it.
Minnesota.
I don't know if there was some sort of connection. Like there was Canadian actors, and that's why they could play it. But it never went off the air here. And
well, that's another thing that's interesting about. And I could be wrong about this, but it's ringing a bell that. Didn't a lot of the Rankin Bass, wasn't it done in Japan or like by a Japanese
the Animagic production company was done in Japan, and that's why a lot of the puppets really didn't survive. That they were over in Japan and they would get trashed while doing it. So I think that
even they were all like drinking sake.
Oh, that would be no,
the
they
just started trashing
afterwards.
The puppets.
But what I mean is they would get used and they would get trashed, and then there didn't seem to be any sort of cadence to, hey, let's save this. They just got destroyed or they got thrown out or that sort of thing. I think if I recall correctly, the Rudolph and the Santa Claus from the iconic Christmas special were used as Christmas decoration in somebody who worked there's house for years. And then, of course, they just got buggered. But that seems so weird, to think about that. These pop culture icons are just in somebody's attic.
Well, yeah, I think it's like that whole era. You know, I was I tracked down some Region 2 DVD set of the Avengers, but the John Seed and Kathy Gale, okay. The Honor Blackman stuff from 62, 63, whatever. And this was, and it was done by ABC was the, it wasn't, I don't think it was a BBC thing or something. And I mean, some of these episodes are live. They shot these things live, and it's incredible when you watch these actors, and there are just a ton of familiar faces that you'd recognize from loads of British movies and Doctor Who and things like that just pop up in these things. And they basically were doing a live play, like even the action sequences, they go from one set and you could almost see them out of breath when they get to the next location. And it's incredible, but it's amazing that they survive, because the BBC was so notorious for wiping the tapes of stuff. Not having any, just thinking about the cost of filming a football match or whatever instead. And it's a miracle that something like Monty Python even survives, because Terry Jones got a phone call like the week it was going to happen or something. Somebody called him in the early 70s from the BBC and said, hey, we've got a bunch of canisters here. They're going to wipe this stuff or whatever. Do you want this stuff? And it was the entire series of Monty Python that he bought. He bought the tapes, as far as I understand. Terry Jones was like, I'll take it. And if he hadn't done that, if that phone call hadn't been made, the majority of those shows would have been wiped. You know, so there was no, I feel like that whole era of the 60s, whether it was, you know, musically or any of these projects, I don't know if anybody really understood remotely what the weight of this stuff could have been, or that it would be around. I don't know what it was. It just, they thought everyone was going to move on to something else and it didn't matter, or it was just a one-off TV special. Just like a TV special that probably won't air again. Just a one-time thing and then no one's going to care, sort of thing. Because Rudolph was, by the time Mad Monster Party happened, Rudolph was what, like 62 or something, or 64 maybe, I think, something like that. And it was a hit, you know, and they'd rerun it every year. And so
it became an evergreen. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's still, to this day, I think they still run it on, you know, close to Christmas or something.
Yeah. I can remember watching it in college. Like, it was a big deal, you know, to still watch that little piece of your childhood.
Totally.
I think that's why I'm such a Halloween kid, is I just, there's so much happiness. And I do like the Christmas specials as well, of course, but there's just something very unique and fun about Halloween that I can't get over, and I refuse to get over.
Well, and truth be told, Rudolph, my favorite bit was always the bumble. Was waiting for the bumble to show up, because it was a monster. It was a big, scary, goofy monster. So Mad Monster Party was like this revelation when I first saw it, that, oh my gosh, there's one of these for Halloween too.
Yeah.
You know? And that's how I think of it. It's, again, I've got it. I've watched it, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago maybe. It's kind of something to have on in the background, I find. But it's gorgeous to look at. It's, you know, there's a bit at the beginning where the lead kid, the Jimmy Stewart kid, is in the drugstore that he works in.
Yeah.
And I think he's like making a tonic or something for himself. And he opens up this jar of pills.
Yeah.
As a kid, you think, oh, it's candy. He's going to have a piece of candy or something. But he opens up this jar, and the pill just drops a couple out into his hand and just downs them. And they're the size of, you know, walnuts, these things, in his little hand. I just love stuff like that. Just that weird, you know, the set design and the props and the, just something gorgeous about watching that animation. And I've always loved it. And that's why Nightmare Before Christmas was such a big deal for me, because it reminded me of all that stuff and somebody finally doing something for Halloween. So speaking of Halloween and all this stuff, there's a couple of things I want to mention. I don't know when this is going to go up, but in case...
It's going up on Halloween.
It's going up on Halloween Day. Well, maybe this will be too late, but there are... If you're into the scary movie vibe and you're looking for stuff, there's a couple of movies, a couple of things I could recommend, one of which is the Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, yeah?
Which, yeah, I got to say, it's heavy, because it's a family kind of drama as well. It's always flashing back to these childhoods, and there's, because of the events of the house and the things with the spooky stuff, all these kids as adults have got issues with things, but it's really, really well written and very, very well acted. But when it goes scary, when it goes, kind of spooky and scary, very, very effective. I was surprised at how good that was. It's, you know, a little tough to get through. I think I've talked about Hereditary, which is one of the most disturbing movies I've seen in recent memory, but very scary. Like, by the time you get to the end of this, but it's more disturbing. But the one that I could not recommend highly enough is a movie called Ghost Stories, which came out this year in the UK. It was done, it's a stage show in London, and it was written by Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman. Jeremy Dyson is one of the four members of the League of Gentlemen.
Okay, I recognize that name.
Yeah, he's never on air, but he's one of the writers and part of the the group. And Andy Nyman is an actor, but he's also, he helps design, like things like Darren Brown's, you know, stage shows and things like that in the UK. And, he's into magic and all that. And so the stage play, which I'd never seen, but I'd heard about, you know, it's all practical effects. It's like a portmanteau. Some of the Hammer stuff, and it's that was their inspiration. But when they made the movie, it's like 99% practical effect. So cool. When the scares come, it is, don't watch it alone is all I can say. It is very, very spooky and beautifully done. Beautifully done. So there's some recommendations if anybody has the inclination to.
I don't have any this year because I've just been going over, like, I decided, well, I'm going to watch all the Halloween series, and then I just can't. I think I could get to 3, and then,
you know, it's funny, I just saw the new one the other night.
How is it?
It's good.
Yeah?
It's good. Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it wasn't knocking me out, and then about, you know, I don't know, once you get to the point where there's like 30 minutes left, it ramps up. And it was good. And she's terrific in it. And, you know, they're trying to live up to this classic film from 40 years ago. Like, nothing is ever going to compare.
No, I think that was real lightning in the bottle. And, like, I can't even really sit through Halloween 2 all that well. I can sit through Halloween 3 because it's just bizarre. Like, it's a bizarre
insane
movie. And it's just, it's its own. If it had been called anything else, I'd probably watch it. And not, like, I probably wouldn't have any sort of issue. So I just kind of walk away from it and go, it's just an insane movie and I kind of like it. And then, but the 4, 5, and 6 kind of get weirder and weirder, and Donald Pleasance gets, you know, sicker and sicker.
The conceit for this is, like, none of the other films happen.
Well, that's
about the first one and
fourth time that's happened, but yeah, that's fine. The films that I'm waiting for, actually, and this is our friends at Severin Films, who sent us those nice movies a few. Released the. It's almost like they were listening to me. They are releasing the Blood Island movies, which are my favorites, on Blu-ray in this deluxe box set, and I just bought it sight unseen. Like, yeah, I got to have that. And, you know, the Blood Island movies are some of my favorite horror. Now, they're not technically well made, but they're just something about them, very driving, very watchable. And they did a deluxe set, and then somebody tipped me off that, like, if I went into a Spirit Halloween store, there's actually a mask of the Beast of Blood from one of the Blood Island movies, and I couldn't believe it. And I'm not a mask guy. I don't collect masks.
Didn't you just post that? Didn't you just buy it?
It's on my desk. I bought it without even thinking. I was like, I have to have this. My wife hates it. And because it's creepy. It's well done. And I put it on a mannequin, so it's got eyes and the whole deal. But I can't believe I live in a world where this exists. You know, like, Mego's back on the store shelves. And there's Blood Island merchandise. Like, I'm in the Matrix, personally, right now.
Well, you know? It's funny you say that, because I forgot, we did the Vincent Price episode, and I forgot to mention, did you know that there was a bobblehead and a mini bust that were made by Rue Morgue, the magazine Rue Morgue, I think? This is, like, their first, you know, licensed sort of product where they're doing...
No, I didn't know they did it. Like, I know other people have done some Vincent Price toys. I think about
These are... brand new. They're limited to, like, you know, 800 pieces or 1,200 pieces or something, and there's just a bobblehead of him dancing with a skeleton, and then this really fun, like, black onyx bust of him, like a 6-inch, you know, bust or something.
No, more power to them. I was, you know, actively lobbying Mego. They have a little group on Facebook called Mego Ambassadors, and I would love to see a Vincent Price Mego. I think people would buy that. You know, I think he's iconic, so I would love to see more of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But you just said something else. You said the mask, the world we're living in. I don't know if I sent you these pictures, but I was at Amoeba, one of my favorite places, a few weeks back. And do you know that they, Anchor Bay? In the UK anyway, Anchor Bay put out these two sets, the Amicus Collection and the Tygon Collection. And their boxes are in the shape of coffins. And I got the Amicus one was, I think, $20, and the Tygon one was like $12. And it's got, and the thing is, they're really, the packaging's fun, but the detail on the extras on the packaging, there's like no detail until you put the movie in and you realize, oh, there are trailers, there's a making of, there's audio commentary. And the other night I watched Blood on Satan's Claw, the Tygon movie, with audio commentary by Jeremy Dyson, Mark Gatiss, and Reese Shearsmith from League of Gentlemen. It's one of their favorite things. And it's on this set, this weird... So the Tygon ones are Witchfinder General, The Body Stealers, The Haunted House of Horror, Blood on Satan's Claw, The Beast in the Cellar, and Virgin Witch.
You know, I got to get into these because that is the third time today I've heard Blood on Satan's Claw.
It's so that disturbing. To me
is
a coincidence.
Is it? I got to check it out because obviously I don't know anything about those films.
And TV's Wendy Padbury is in Blood on Satan's Claw.
Oh, okay. That's how I know that movie because I think she gets a little nude.
She's not the only one. It's funny listening to their audio commentary where you get to certain scenes and they're going, look at that. I mean, my God, how is this possible? This was in a horror movie back then. And, you know, they're all kind of obsessed with, they talk about their influences. It was a great book. If anybody knows League of Gentlemen or likes these guys, there's a wonderful book called, I think it's called Precious Things or Our Precious Things, which is riffing on a character from the League of Gentlemen, where each of the four of them take sections of the book and write chapters on the things they love so much, whether it's Hammer Horror or Doctor Who or Reese Shearsmith goes on about Exorcist 3 and how much he loves that movie and how effective it is. And it's a great little book just to kind of...
I gotta think the League of Gentlemen guys are big fans of The Wicker Man.
Oh, huge.
Because that show just has Royston Vasey feels like you're about to get sacrificed in that town, right? Like
it's huge, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The movie that was out a few years ago that Shearsmith was in. Oh my God, I'm can't think of it now, but it's a very strange I think it's black and white, maybe, but it's, I can't think of it. But he's in it, and he's amazing in it. He just, the way he starts to get more strange as the movie goes on, it's from the tip of my tongue. It's, oh my God, I'll think of it. But yes, The Wicker Man, it's huge with them. Any of the Hammer and the Amicus stuff, and you can see the underlying vibe of weirdness in a lot of their stuff.
The Mad Monster Party thing is that, you know, we like to see horror / humor, you know, we like to make our horror funnier, but these guys actually were making their comedy more horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And which reminds me, because we've talked about this before too, and it's in the same vein, that show I keep going on about, Inside Number 9, which is Reese Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton from the League of Gentlemen. That is now, season 1 through 3 are now on Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay. I just discovered I have that.
Okay, then you should check it out. It's an anthology show, so every episode is different. But the marriage of whether it's, you know, disturbing or scary or... slapstick with darkness, whether it's violence or horror or whatever, it's an incredible marriage in each one of these things. It's really, really well done. So 1 through 3, I think, are on Amazon Prime, and then I think the fourth season, there's a thing called BritBox, that you can get on,
I can't
on
get
Amazon,
that.
I think?
I don't think I can
get Oh, you can't
that.
Get them?
No.
Okay.
You know,
so it's all out there.
I think I've tapped out on streaming services too. Like, it's getting to the point. Like, you know, DC's got one, and I knew this was coming, but it's like, oh boy, you know, enough.
The movie I was thinking of, A Field in England. It's called A Field in England.
That sounds dull as toast, but I'll check it out.
It is very, it is black and white, if I remember, and it's very Wicker Man-ish. And it was done by Ben Wheatley, who's an incredible writer-director. And did you see that one called High Rise, after the J.G. Ballard book, with Tom Hiddleston's in it, Shear Smith is in it?
Yeah,
again,
I did.
Very
what,
strange.
What
okay.
the hell did I just watch there? I saw that.
Just the decadence of what happens in this high rise, and they're cut off from civilization down below, and it just gets more and more strange and
yeah,
a weird
yeah.
movie.
I saw it. I watched it. I wasn't sure what I was watching.
Yeah, so the same guy did this A Field in England, and it's something to check out late at night, some night when you're all by yourself in the basement.
That sounds
you
want to
get scared. But there you go.
Yeah, there you go, guys. And I know we rambled. Mad Monster Party, an affectionate a movie we both have deep affection for. If you have not seen it, check it out. If you have kids, even better.
Yes. Yes, I think we covered it very well, even though we talked about
everything
lots
around
of other
it.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Everything around it for a good 10 or 15 minutes.
I don't think that disappoints I don't think that disappoints anyone who listens to us.
No, I don't think so.
So, happy Halloween, everybody. Hope you have fun, are safe, and we'll talk to you in November.
Talk soon. Thanks, everyone.